Hi, this is Ahmed Sharif, and in today's episode, we are joined by a senior analyst at PRS Legislative Research, Suyash Tiwari, to probe the farm laws and to get to know them better. Hi, Suyash. Welcome to DH Radio.
Yeah, hi, Ahmed.
Yeah, hope you're doing good.
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Hope you are doing well too.
Yes, same here. Yeah. So we'll straight up start with the questions. So can you briefly explain to us the three farm bills over which there are protests across the country?
So if you see the way agricultural produce is presently regulated, right? The marketing part of it is the way it is regulated right now. And we are only talking about the first step of the supply chain, which is where the farmers sell their produce to, say, buyer, trader, commission agent, wherever. So that part is regulated by the APMC market. So agricultural produce marketing committees, these committees are set up under state laws. So state laws meant to regulate the entire agricultural marketing system, from the way these farmers can sell their produce, where they can sell this produce, who can buy that produce, and what kind of other measures that need to be taken care of when such a transaction takes place, and who is the regulatory authority to intervene in case a dispute arises here. So the three bills passed by Parliament recently, they mainly try to intervene in this step of trade, where the farmer is selling his or her produce to the next player or next to the buyer. One of the three bills, what it tries to do is it wants to make it easier for buyers to buy directly from farmers. So right now, if let's say a buyer needs to buy a farmer's produce, they need to have a license from these APMCs. So and it varies a bit from state to state. In some state, it's like a APMC specific license. So if you have a license from one APMC, you can't go and trade or buy from in the area of another APMC market, another APMC. That is one. Or some states have a statewide trading license where you need to obtain a statewide license, and then you can go around in that state and buy from anywhere. So that is one thing which one of these bills wants to change. The Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Bill, it now basically provides that anyone with a PAN card can go and buy farmers produce directly, you know, without really having any kind of license. And this is something which applies only to certain specific areas. So under the present system, the way APMCs regulate market, there are certain markets owned by the government or the APMCs themselves. So those are like APMC owned markets or APMC markets. Then there are certain market yards which are, say, even if they are, you know, operated by some private players, they have taken license from APMCs to operate those markets. So essentially all the markets which are directly under APMCs control or for which APMCs have given license, those under the Trade and Commerce Bill have been considered as APMC's own area. So there, the bill is not really making any intervention, or the bill is not really making any difference there. There, the system will continue to operate as it is right now. What the bill tries to do in all other areas, basically your trade area outside your APMC markets, the bill tries to simplify the manner in which buyers can go and buy farmers' produce. So one is the licensing part, that it is changing it from a license to a simple provision of a PAN card. So that is one. And the other is also the charge that you have to pay for buying the farmers' produce. So at present, if you are buying in the APMC markets or anywhere in their jurisdiction, you have to pay certain charges levied by the APMCs. So that won't be applicable in the outside trade area, where the bill is, you know, trying to simplify things for buyers. So that is another aspect, that APMCs or in the state government cannot levy any charge in the outside trade area. That's largely about the first bill, the Trade and Commerce Bill. This is one general practice of trade, like how the trade will take place. Now there is a particular special form of trade where private player or a company or anyone who wants to, you know, engage with farmer on a slightly longish, long-term basis. So what they can do there is maybe go to the farmer before the sowing starts, before the crop season starts. And then there, they can go and sign like a contract or agreement with the farmer. So it's essentially called contract farming if you are doing farming under the pre-agreed contract. So what the aim of this contract is, it is to make sure that the buyer who is signing that contract, also called sponsor, so they have, an assured supply from the farmer's side. So they at least know that, the farm, that they will be able to get this much amount of produce from the buyer that they have signed this contract with. And they can also specify various other conditions, right? That it needs to be grown in a certain manner, what kind of pesticides to use, what kind of seeds to use, so various other things. So that is one. And the benefit for farmer here is that once you have this pre-agreed contract, farmers can also be assured of, a buyer, that someone will buy their produce, and also the price that they agree beforehand, the farmer will able to, at least get that price. So what the second bill tries to do, the second bill is called the Farmers Empowerment and Protection Agreement on Price Assurance and Farm Services Bill. So what it tries to do is just provides a framework for those who want to engage in such practice of contract farming, so that, farmers and buyers both have like some kind of guideline as to how to, design these contract farming agreements. What are the different things that, needs to be taken care of? What are the different things that the contract should specify? Like there should be a, minimum guaranteed price, which needs to be specified beforehand. And there can be a provision in the contract that if, let's say, when after the harvesting is done and when the time really comes for the transaction to take place, then if there is a higher price prevailing in nearby market, then farmer should also be able to, get some kind of bonus out of that higher price. So that is largely what the second bill is trying to do. And it also provides for like a dispute settlement mechanism that these parties can, go to if in case any dispute arises. And this dispute mechanism is also available in the first bill, which we talked about, where any general on-the-spot trade transaction is taking place. That's largely about the second bill, the one which relates to contract farming. The third one is an amendment to the Essential Commodities Act. So if we look at the Essential Commodities Act now, the way it is designed, it allows the central and state governments to regulate a lot of things related to essential commodities. So be it production, trade, distribution, price, storage. So governments can regulate a lot of these things right now for certain essential commodities, and these essential commodities can be notified by the government. So for example, recently masks and hand sanitizers were notified as essential commodities. So that is one. So example. So now what the bill is trying to do is, first it is saying that any kind of regulation by the government, by any of these governments in relation to agricultural produce should be, done in very extraordinary circumstances. So, such as, war, famine, or if there is any extraordinary price rise. So these certain, food items or any such items which will be notified, these can only be regulated under these extraordinary circumstances. So that is one. The other thing is that if let's say the government wants to regulate the stock of any essential commodity, so as I mentioned, storage is also one of the things that the government can regulate. So it can put stock limits on how much an individual person can hold at maximum at a particular point of time. Now what the bill is trying to do is that stock limits can only be imposed based on price rise. So there are certain price rice levels defined in the bill, in the law itself. So once those levels are hit, then the government may, you know, choose to specify a stock limit. It's not necessary that it will, it has to definitely do that. It has a choice that whether it wants to do that. And just to give a sense of these price rise levels. So if, let's say, in case of any horticultural produce, such as, you know, fruits and vegetables, if there is a 100% increase in retail price over the last year's price, then stock limits can be imposed, or in case of other non-perishable food stuff, it can be, you know, a 50%, it can be imposed on a 50% increase in retail price. So that's largely the main idea. And there is a provision there in the Essential Commodities Amendment Bill, which gives exemption to, you know, certain players who are engaged in the value chain process for these, you know, food items. So for example, if, let's say, there is a processor who is mainly using, say, one of these agricultural commodities for processing it and converting it into another food item, or any other participant who is part of these this value chain, or any exporter who is exporting these commodities. So there are certain exemptions available to them under the under these stock limits. So even if, let's say, the government imposes these stock limits once this price rise level is reached, then still these certain players will be able to do their business as usual, because they have been given some exemption. And that's largely the idea of the exemption, that their, you know, business should not get affected, because the idea of deregulating or relaxing some of these stringent stock limit conditions is that what these stock limits at present do is they impose like a certain kind of sense of fear on people who are want to do trade or business in this sector, and they want to, you know, say, let's say, for particular company's business requires it to store, you know, tomatoes or onions for its, say, processing. So now if, let's say, a stock limit is imposed, then it has a, you know, a risk of, like, it will have to give away a lot of its present stock, present storage amount, and it will only be able to hold a certain amount of it with itself for its business. So what it does is it creates like a disincentive for these businesses to do their business, scale up their business. So if you try to scale up your business by storing a lot of these commodities, then there's always this risk. So there was this recommendation made by, you know, expert committees over the years, that there should be some kind of distinction here between people who want to store these commodities for, you know, their genuine, you know, business purposes, and those who want to just hold these commodities for taking advantage of, you know, price increases. The idea of these stock limits was to make sure that hoarding does not happen. But now with these stock limits remaining there for, you know, so many years, what it has done is it has also disincentivized people who want to really invest in it for doing business. So that is also another idea. That is the kind of the main idea here, that once you define these price rise levels, and once you define these conditions where people are also being given exemptions, and the government wants to, like, bring some kind of predictability into the system, you know, in the manner in which these stock limits will be imposed, so that people are actually able to do like long-term investment in storage of these commodities. And also, even if, let's say, they are not storing it, they should be able to at least do buy and sell in bulk amount without really worrying about these stock limits.
So you spoke about each of the three bills in detail. Now let's get into the nitty-gritties of each of them. So the first be the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Bill. Now, this particular bill talks about doing away with middlemen. And can you shed some more light on that? And what was the situation before? And how, after this, when this bill comes into effect, what would be the situation? So could you give a comparison there?
Yes. So essentially, one of the main, you know, issues with the APMCs, you know, working at present, one of the main issues that has been observed by, you know, various experts and various committees over the years is that there is very little competition in these markets for buying farmers' produce. So if let's say there are a certain number of traders or say a certain number of commission agents present in the market to facilitate such transaction, what has ended up happening is that these players among themselves have formed a cartel kind of setup, so they can get together and control what the price that will go to the farmer. One thing is that right from say the farm gate to the place where it is being consumed, if the distance is very far, that could lead to a lot of middlemen coming in. But also even at the first stage where this transaction is taking place, if the APMC market don't really allow for the competition to come in. So if let's say a new buyer has to come in, they need to obtain a license, and these licensing conditions were being seen as like a deterrent for new buyers to come in easily. So that was kind of creating a disincentive for people who want to buy farmers' produce directly. And that was a part of it was also was due to the kind of competition system, the kind of setup that now they are in the APMCs across the various states, that these traders and commission agents are now formed like a cartel, and they are not really allowing much competition to come in. Both central and state governments have been trying to resolve this issue through various measures. So one of the ways in which the reforms were being thought of, so one of the main ideas was to allow private players to not just come in within the APMC markets itself, but also set up say their own markets outside the APMC market. So it could be private market yard, it could be a farmer to consumer direct market, or they can also set up their own collection centers near farm gate and buy directly from farmers, or there could be e-trading platforms that could be set up. So those can also be there. How this was being thought of was that central government had formulated a model APMC Act. So this was released in 2017. So the idea was that states can look at this model APMC Act and reform their existing acts to bring them in line with the spirit of the model APMC Act, that you make it easier for new players to come in. And the idea being that it should lead to more competition in the system, and thus if there's more competition, it could lead to better prices for farmers. So that was largely the idea in which the this was being thought of. After the model APMC Act was issued, states had started introducing or implementing some of these changes in their own laws. So while some had completely adopted the new law, but many others had were doing it in a piecemeal manner. So some were allowing private markets, but they were not allowing a certain set of other things, or even if they are allowing it, there are certain conditions. So one of the observations that has been by experts is that so far it has not really adoption of model act by states has not really led to that kind of result which was expected with these model acts. So again, last year there was this committee which was constituted by the central government to think about these reforms again, that how can we make it easier for states to adopt these model laws, and even what kind of changes would the Essential Commodities Act would require to make it easier for businesses to come in and participate. So this was largely the one of the main issues which was there, that how do you allow more competition in the system. And so even parliamentary standing committees have looked at this issue. So the agriculture committee said that there's not really a great response from states to these model act reforms that which allow for greater competition. So maybe the central government should think about taking states, doing consultation with states and forming like a group of agriculture ministers of states. So something like the way GST was thought of. So if you have this committee of ministers which is deliberating on how these model act reforms can be implemented, how we can think about the competition, increasing the competition. So that could, you know, result in better prices for farmers and also improving the entire agricultural marketing system. So that was largely the idea. But now with these new bills coming in, we have this essentially it's now like a system where on one hand there are certain set of markets which are, you know, being regulated by states or APMCs. So they have their own set of regulations there. And on the other hand, you have this outside trade area where the central government is, you know, intervening and trying to make sure that they are not really too much restrictions on trade. So that allows for, competition to come in and new buyers to come in, which was kind of the issue being observed with the APMC laws.
Now, again, the thing is that when you are talking about multiple players, right, so as it is being claimed in the protests and all, will this benefit the corporates and what is in for the farmer? And when you talk about a competition, right, like, do we have a watchdog here?
So if you look at the present system, like if you look at the kind of, you know, people who are, you know, really buying produce inside these APMC markets, they are also, you know, private players in a sense. I mean, they are not really, there's not really too much government involvement in purchase of farmers' produce, except a few commodities where the government, you know, goes and buys directly from farmers at, you know, I mean, not directly, but through its procurement agencies, the government buys from these farmers at minimum support price. So if I have to just, you know, give the example. So government procurement right now is largely done for rice and wheat. So if we have to think about in terms of production, so of all the production, rice production that takes place, 43% is bought by the government. And for wheat, it's like 36% of wheat is bought by the government. So these are the two commodities where, you know, government involvement is there. And government also has also now started buying pulses and coarse grains in some amount, but that is still relatively very less. So if we ignore these, you know, specific commodities, rest all of it is anyway already, you know, done by the private sector. So private sector, you know, could be in multiple forms. It could be, you know, small traders who are buying this mainly for, you know, their local supply chain, where they are just passing it on to the next big trader in the nearby town or city. Or it could be, you know, a well-established private player or a private company which is using it for its own business. So it could be processing it directly, or it would be just selling it at various, supplying it to various cities for further sale. So that is one thing there, that who exactly is buying right now and who exactly is participating in the trade. So when we think about government procurement, it's largely focused on these commodities, because government procures these largely to fulfill the requirement of the public distribution system. So the kind of commodities the government needs to supply under the PDS system, it only procures those and maybe a little bit more than that to maintain some kind of buffer stock in the interest of food security. So, but other than that, all of it is private. So now with these bills coming in, the idea is that the kind of, you know, players who are able to participate or buy produce right now, that is kind of limited because of these licensing conditions. So the idea of these bills is that one is you make it easy for more private players to come in. The other is you remove any stock limit conditions that are there right now to allow them to buy and sell and store in bulk quantity. So now if we have to think about the kind of private trade that can happen, now they can really scale up their businesses to very high volume. At present, because of the stock limit conditions, there was definitely for some commodities, there was this kind of restriction in the way, the manner in which private players were buying and selling. So that is one part, how these bills can change now. And if we look at the what kind of mechanism is there to oversee the transaction. So at present, the APMCs have the, you know, authority or jurisdiction. So they are the people who are keeping a watch on, you know, what kind of trade or transaction is taking place within their jurisdiction. And they are the, you know, first, you know, level of authorities who deal with any kind of disputes which may arise from such transactions. So if a farmer say, and there could be, you know, many kind of issues which can arise if, let's say, trade is taking place. So one simple thing is the payment related issues, that whether the farmer is getting payment on time or not. Then there are more, you know, complicated issues which could come up, like the way in which quality of a produce is assessed, whether both sides really agree with that or not, that how much price such quality of produce should get. So that is another part. Then there are also, you know, things like the weights buyers are using to weigh these quantities. So if farmers feel there is any kind of, you know, fault in some of those weighing instruments, because these primarily these APMC markets are like big wholesale markets. So the amount being traded is like a lot. So if even if, let's say, there is a small weighing difference, that could make a lot of difference in terms of like the amount farmer gets. So if farmer faces any of these issues, they can go to the, you know, APMC, the committee directly, and the committee will intervene and, you know, see that the dispute gets resolved. So that is largely the framework of, and this will continue to operate in the present system itself, but it will be only limited to the trade that is taking place inside the APMC markets. Now, outside the APMC markets, if there is any trade taking place, there is a dispute settlement mechanism specified under the bills itself. So primarily, subdivisional magistrate or SDM is the main authority who will be the first point of contact. So if any dispute arises, you can go to the SDM, and the SDM will first set up a conciliation board to engage the two parties and make sure that the dispute gets resolved through conciliation. And if that does not happen, SDM will take a call himself. And even if the parties want to appeal against the SDM decision, then it goes to the collector, and then collector will be the final authority on this. So that is one dispute settlement mechanism specified under the bill, under these laws. So other than this, there are only largely two instances of government involvement. One, if there is any, you know, contract farming arrangement that a farmer is entering into with a private player or with a buyer or a sponsor. So the state governments may set up, you know, a registration authority, which will definitely, one is register all of these contract farming arrangements that are being entered into. And the rest of the things are up to the state government. So the law does not clearly says what are the different things the registration authority can do. But there, at least the state governments have some powers, we can say, that some things that state governments can specify how things will work. But if you look at the first bill, which is the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Bill, the only other mechanism available is that the central government, if it thinks that it is necessary and in public interest, it can prescribe a registration system. So whatever trade is happening in the outside trade area, outside APMC markets, a registration system can be thought of for that kind of trade. That's largely if we have to talk about like what kind of government oversight or what kind of regulation is there, that's largely it.
No, coming back to this second bill, right, that is the agreement of price assurance. Now it talks about, and you said about contract farming, and you know, how will it affect the MSP and farm income? Like, what has been the government's vision, and what may happen because you know, if this law is misused? Could you shed some light on that?
So, contract farming is anyway, I mean, even at present, it's quite limited in that sense. I mean, in terms of how many farmers practice contract farming or how many buyers engage in contract farming, that is not really too much. So one is that the bill, it gives freedom to the two parties, farmer and buyer or sponsor, to decide what is the kind of arrangement they want to enter into. So the price that the parties agree on, that really does not really have anything to do with MSP, since MSP is something which is only related to government procurement. So MSP is not really something which is a part of these arrangements. So, but there is something called a guaranteed, you know, minimum guaranteed price, which the agreement needs to specify. And now at what level will that price be? There is not really any condition on that. That is up to the two parties to decide. So once they decide on that, you know, minimum guaranteed price, if let's say a few months later when the crop is harvested or when the transaction is taking place, if say the price in the nearest APMC market or if any other benchmark price specified in the agreement, so if that benchmark price is above the guaranteed minimum price, there can be, you know, some kind of bonus which the farmer can be given. And all of these will need to be specified in the farming agreement or the contract farming agreement, that, you know, what kind of conditions will, under which the price will, can change. But there has to be a minimum price. That is one thing which the bill says. Yeah, other than that, there could be multiple ways in which price can be thought of later, but it just puts a floor, but that has not really anything to do with the MSP specified by the government. So one thing I want to add here for the contract farming agreement. So largely the idea here is to allow buyers to engage with farmers where they feel that, you know, a long-term engagement. So long-term as in at least a season-long engagement, you know, makes sense for them. So for example, if let's say a buyer wants to just buy any normal produce of any variety, so if they want to just buy, say, potato of any variety, they don't really have too many requirements on what kind of potato it should be, then they may, you know, prefer to directly buy from the market on the spot rather than, you know, going to the farmer a few months ago when the sowing is taking place. So this kind of mechanism, from like what I have studied and what I have heard from experts, so this kind of mechanism is largely designed to work in cases where either the commodity is very specialized in nature. So let's say if a particular buyer needs a very particular variety of potato for its business operation, or where they need a very particular, or they need the produce to be grown in a very particular way. So if you want the produce to be completely free of pesticides, you can engage with a farmer and you can, you know, discuss with them and put it in the agreement, like what kind of conditions should there be for the produce. So these kind of arrangements are more likely to operate in such specialized cases. And some other examples which have been brought in this context is, contract farming is sometimes used for, say, seed production or poultry production. So there are some of these cases as well where this can be seen. But since this is just a mechanism to facilitate contract farming, it is not really making anything mandatory for anyone. So it's up to, I guess, the farmers also to, I mean, depending on how much confidence they feel, confident they are really are about these contract farming agreements, if they see some value in engaging in such arrangements, only then we can, I think, expect that these kind of arrangements will actually be in practice for even other general commodities.
Now, and you talked about the essential commodities, right? And basically, the aim of the act was to have a limit on the stock holdings. So is it more than what meets the eye? What I'm talking about is basically when a particular item is bought under the essential commodity as a designated as an essential commodity, what does it mean?
The basic idea is that if there is any item, so any, it could be a food item or it could be any other item as well. If the government considers it as an essential commodity, which means that there is, you know, some kind of scope that, let's say, if there is any shortfall in the supply of that commodity in the market, the government is willing to, you know, take measures to make sure that the commodity is available to, you know, its consumers. There is no like shortage there. So one is the supply. Then another aspect could be, you know, price, that at what price is that commodity available, since an essential commodity is something which is considered, you know, very vital for, say, our day-to-day consumption, or even just considered an item of, you know, mass consumption. So the government is, you know, keeping some kind of power with itself to make sure that it can intervene to maybe regulate at the price at which that essential commodity is sold. So that essentially one of the main ideas with the stock limit is, as I mentioned, that no one should, you know, hoard these supplies or hoard these commodities with them. So that, and the idea with hoarding is essentially that let's say if a particular trader wants to make more profit from selling these commodities, they would want to maybe not really release much of the supply when the prices are low. But when the prices rise at a later stage, the idea is to, the hoarder would, you know, want to maybe take advantage of the price rise and maybe control the supply in that manner. So the idea of stock limit is that government can intervene in such cases and prevent such kind of hoarding practice, to make sure that there is a continuous, you know, supply of these essential commodities. But when we look at, you know, food items, so like, let's take one example. So let's say if it's a commodity which is kind of, you know, perishable in nature, and there is not really a well-developed storage system there. So in case of those commodities, so let's take the example of onion. What might happen is that when there are a few cycles or few instances in the year, so it may be two or three or four times, where when that, you know, produce is harvested and when that new supply comes into the market. So if there is a lot of supply coming in at the same time, what it could do, and demand is something which we can, you know, assume is more or less constant throughout the year. So if there is a lot of supply coming in at those particular points of time, what it could lead to is the prices could really go down to an extent where farmers are not even able to make recover the price amount they have invested in growing those commodities. So one is with these commodities, one of the risks is that where too much of that supply comes in at the same time. And we have seen this with all milk as well, or, you know, some other commodities where farmers are forced to dump their produce instead of selling them because they're not really getting much money out of it. So one is there could be these kind of instances where prices are really crashing because there is too much supply. On the other hand, there could be, you know, certain other instances during the year where because this new supply comes only a particular time during the year, during the rest of the year, there could be, you know, instances where because there is no new supply coming in and the produce which the new supply which came, say, in the previous harvest, that is not really lasted enough. So something like what is kind of happened a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, onion prices started to increase because there was not really enough supply there. So there could be, there's this kind of fluctuation which was seen, that there are some instances where the prices are really crashing and there are some instances where the prices are really rising. So the idea of encouraging storage by removing these stock limits is also that, so let's say if a farmer it could a farmer can also do it, a trader can also do it. So if any of them, you know, have that kind of storage facility available with them where they can, you know, store this onion with them throughout, you know, the year, and they are not really forced to sell all of it at the first instance, you know, when it comes. So what it will allow is it will give them that kind of flexibility and power to maybe sell less produce when the prices are low, and maybe sell more when the prices are high, so that they are also able to make some profit. And also this would lead to at least some kind of price stabilization over the year, and not really, you know, just such volatility in prices where prices are either too low or too high. So that is the one of the ideas of removing the stock limits. But definitely this all has a negative side for consumers, that if we are thinking about a system where the farmer should, or the traders, or those who are doing business in these agricultural commodities, if we are thinking of a system where they should be able to, you know, take advantage of these storage systems to get more profit, definitely that profit is going to come from consumers. So in those cases, since the government is thinking of some kind of deregulation and thinking of, you know, not really interfering too much by imposing these stock limits, there could be some, you know, cases where consumers may be required to pay higher price. And that is essentially one of the key arguments, like, you know, where should the balance lie between, say, consumer versus producers in terms of trade. So that's essentially the idea.
Talking about this, like being in the same line, do you think that such regulations or such policies will discourage farmers from taking up cultivation of certain produce? Do you see that happening?
You mean the essential commodities stock limits?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
See, if we have to think about, you know, who will be able to benefit out of these out of this new system, like, you know, removal of stock limits, then we also need to see, like, who is able to really store these commodities for their business requirements. So for example, if a farmer is not really able to store in the first place, so then we will still see a scenario where farmer will have to, you know, sell all of his or her produce at the first instance, you know, when that produce comes to the market. So that is a very important part, that whether you know, farmers are able to able to invest in such kind of, you know, storage spaces for their commodities. And this is something, again, storage is not really something like a, you know, just a simple storage. For many commodities, you need a specialized kind of storage, like cold storage facilities. So, and cold storage facilities also require like a very good power supply. So if these kind of supporting infrastructure is not there, then any removal of stock limit may not really help the farmer, and farmer may not really be able to take any advantage here. There are certain programs or schemes which the government has thought of and has announced under the economic package. So there is this 1 lakh crore fund where it wants farmers to take advantage of that fund to, you know, take credit and use it for investing in farm gate infrastructure. So this storage can be one kind of example of this farm gate infrastructure that but there is also another problem, and it's not just about the storage itself. A lot of especially these small and marginal farmers, they depend on informal sources for a lot of their credit as well. So if, let's say, farmers are really, you know, too much dependent on credit, and the way they don't really have much working capital at hand, so what might happen and what, you know, usually happens in many cases is they are forced to, like, quickly sell their produce to get some cash in hand, and in turn they use that cash to, say, pay some of the debt and or use it for buying inputs for the next season. Or so there's that cash flow problem which still exists. I mean, despite, you know, easing all these regulations, that is one problem which, I mean, that will require, you know, additional measures to be taken by the government to make sure that farmers have enough, you know, cash have access to that kind of, you know, credit flow, so that they can, you know, at least think about storing these commodities for a longer term, and they are not really forced to sell all of it at one go. So that is another important point. And in terms of commodities, I don't really see, I mean, I think it largely depends on the market. So stock limit is something which, I mean, so one of the things I want to also mention here, that while stock limit is, you know, one kind of measures that the government is relaxing, where the government is giving up its control or deregulating, but there is also another way in which it regulates the trade of commodities, and that is through the import and export conditions that the government can specify. So for example, one of the recent instances that we saw where onion prices were rising, and farmers were, you know, farmers and traders, they were not just, you know, selling it within the country, but also exporting it to other countries, you know, to take advantage of the prices that were available. But what the government did was it basically banned the export of these commodities in the seeing the price levels that were, visible at that point of time. So that is also another thing which might, you know, disincentivize farmers from when they are thinking about particular commodities. So depending on how the government implements the, one is the stock limit conditions. So under the bill, the government has said that it will only impose the stock limit conditions only in certain cases. But when we see the price, retail price of these commodities, certain commodities, so for example, onion is one of them, but so for such commodities, that price level will be very frequently met. It's not really something which is, impossible. It will be frequently met. So then the government, it is up to the government, you know, to take a call whether it wants to impose a stock limit or not. So that is one set of regulation where the government can intervene, and the other is trade will. Export import related restrictions. So depending largely, I mean, the from what I have studied and read, the opinion is largely that farmers and even private companies, players will mainly wait and watch and see how the government is implementing these new set of regulations, new set of relaxed conditions, how the government is implementing these, and if they see benefit or advantage in investing in a few commodities, then they will go ahead with that.
So yes, my final question to you would be, like, considering the fact that these three bills, right, they've been bought and they've been passed in a situation of heightened economic distress, that is during the pandemic, how do you see the combination of three of them affecting the economy?
So one of the things which we saw as soon as the lockdown was announced, that there was this push from the central government central government wanted to encourage states to, you know, allow farmers to engage more in direct marketing from their farm gates itself. So they don't really need to come to, say, the nearest APMC market to sell their produce. So that was one thing which was being encouraged. So that is something which we can think about, or that is something which can be seen as a kind of, you know, incentive for the government to move in this direction, that they really want to open up. But essentially, this is something, I mean, if we have to look at all the three, bills or laws together, these are really very large structural changes, which are not really just limited to, say, what was the effect of the pandemic or what was the immediate issues which farmers faced during these last few months. These are mainly aimed to at least attempt to resolve or address some of the issues which farmers have been facing for, several years. So that is one thing which is actually something very strange, that now that there are these structural issues which farmers have faced in selling their produce, and So one is, you know, there are issues specific to the APMCs or the way or the price at which farmers can sell their produce. But there are also a lot set of other issues governing, you know, the whole agricultural ecosystem, the kind of, you know, produce these farmers are able to generate from their land. I mean, most of the landholders are small. And one important point I would like to highlight here is that these APMC markets are not really, you know, very widespread across the country. So if you have to think about, you know, the extent of availability of these APMC markets across the country, while the recommendation of committees has been that there should be, you know, one market in which should cover areas, what we really see is that the average area covered by these committees is these APMC markets is, you know, 4 to 5 times more than that. So that is one issue, that these farm markets are not really, you know, very well widespread. And what this results in is that most of the small and marginal farmers, so if we have to just think about how 6% of the land holdings are owned by these small and marginal farmers. So most of these small and marginal farmers do not really even have, you know, that much surplus available at hand to sell in these APMC markets. So they end up selling their produce outside the APMC market. So the, you know, we talked about and what the bill or these laws try to address. So at least a lot of them, a lot of those issues don't really even, you know, affect these small and marginal farmers, because there are other challenges which they are deal with, which they have to deal with to make sure that they are able to, you know, get some remunerative prices for their produce. So that is another issue. And one of the kind of, you know, recommendations in this is that farmers have access to, you know, small rural markets in their nearby areas itself, and those markets should be, you know, really well equipped with infrastructure that allows them to take advantage of these, you know, the spirit of these bills is that only that, you know, encourage more competition, but the supporting infrastructure or the supporting ecosystem that you need, that is something which has been recommended, you know, in various measures by committees, that you should have these smaller markets, smaller accessible markets for these farmers who are not even able to access APMCs. So that is one, you know, set of issues that these farmers face. Another set of issues is definitely when, let's say, we think about a new private player going to these markets and, you know, doing trade there. So it could be a large company or it could be like a, you know, a smaller trader. So they, it may be very, you know, difficult for them to engage with, say, hundreds of farmers when we see that there are these small and marginal farmers who have very little produce on their own. So what has been recommended to deal with this is there should be some kind of aggregation mechanism. So farmers themselves can aggregate themselves to form like a farmer producer organization, and that in turn sells the produce to a, you know, new private player coming in, or even it can set up its own market platform. So that is one issue, that aggregation, unless I mean that happens, it may not really, you know, yield that kind of result. So if, let's say, if you have to think about the present system, so if there are a few areas where, you know, all of these factors are kind of addressed, and if we can expect that new private players are coming in and doing trade with farmers. So wherever such, you know, private players are coming in, are able to do trade with farmers, those areas may, you know, see more competition and in turn may lead to, you know, better prices for farmers. But definitely, I mean, in, if we have to think about, I mean, the entire country, different states have really have, you know, different kind of commodities that are dominant in that region. So we, it's probably a bit difficult to think that, you know, private player, new competition will come in at all of these places, in all of the districts, in all of these states. So definitely there, once these, you know, laws are implemented, and depending on the kind of implementation we see, some of the areas which are not really able to get advantage of these reforms, they may require, you know, some kind of supporting mechanism, say it be it from the central government or the state governments, to allow farmers in those areas to also benefit as well. And that is something which probably could have been thought of even before the laws were formulated. Typically, I mean, what we typically see for other laws, so I mean, if we have to think about like the kind of process which is followed for any law before it is enacted, so typically one is there could be a, you know, consultation that the government does with various stakeholders before introducing the bill to parliament. So, which is essentially comes under its pre-legislative consultation policy, which specifies that the government needs to do that kind of consultation and invite comments for at least a certain number of days before introducing a bill to parliament. So that one step is that. The other step is scrutiny that happens within the parliament. Even after the government has done its due consultation, when the bill comes to parliament, if the bill is sent to a, say, a parliamentary committee, then the parliamentary committee in itself does that kind of consultation separately with a range of stakeholders to decide and figure out like what kind of issues need to be addressed. So if we have to think about the environment in which these bills have been introduced, or the what really led to the introduction of these laws, there is very little, at least there seems to be very little conversation in this line, that what if there has to be a central legislation on agricultural marketing, what kind of legislation should it be? Because so far the conversation was mostly centered around how central government can, you know, incentivize or encourage states to introduce these reforms through their APMC laws. So if we have to think about these present bills which have been passed by parliament, there seems to be very little consultation which took place with these laws. So maybe some of that would have benefited some of these issues which largely still remain, because since this is a very complex area of regulation, because each commodity could present its own different set of challenges. So how different states should now respond in response to these laws, that is something which is not really very clear right now, and it probably remains to be seen how different states will respond. Because at least so far, some states have started taking some measures to make sure that the private players who are operating at present within their APMC markets, they are not really at a disadvantage, only because the new laws allow, tax-free trade outside the APMC market. So some states have started rationalizing their APMC charges that is levied. And that is also one of the ideas of the new laws, that the new laws even force the APMC markets to make themselves more efficient in providing the kind of services they provide, and also the cost at which they provide that. So, but certainly with these new set of laws coming in, the idea is that only with more competition coming in will it benefit farmers and lead to better prices. And APMCs are meant to, serve as kind of a benchmark price which farmers can access if, let's say, they don't really see any new buyer coming in, or if they feel that the trade transaction is not really that much favorable for them. So they may continue to come to APMC markets. But another part of it which remains to be seen is how will different states allow, or how will different states adapt these new laws. So for example, while in some cases we do hear about states moving in this direction where they want to rationalize the charges, but there are also, there is also uncertainty in many states on how the new regulation will actually work. And read about in the past couple of weeks, there is kind of consultation going on with the state government, that how is the state government really adapting these changes.
So it's more like a wait and watch sort of a game, if you can.
Yeah, at least seems like it. And even not just for, you know, the state governments, like how they do it, but even for farmers and private players, this is more like since essentially the idea is that you want to bring in these new set of players or, you know, at least more private players to come and buy produce from farmers, the idea should at least be, you know, to give that kind of confidence to not just the private players to come in and do this trade or do that kind of investment in setting up, say, collection centers or markets. So, but the idea is also to, give farmers that kind of confidence that, you know, even if they engage with these new set of private players outside the APMC's watch, even then they will be guaranteed this fair trade and, you know, the kind of payment, the kind of payment mechanism that will work, or the kind of quality related or other kind of disputes which may arise, they will be addressed. Until and unless we see that kind of confidence from the farmer side as well, it remains to be seen whether or how much the new bills will, you know, give results.
All right, Suyash, thank you for talking to Deccan Herald.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's all in today's episode. Tune in this evening on a news update podcast from the newsroom to catch all the exciting developments of the day and to get the news while it's still budding. For latest news and updates, log on to www.deccanherald.com. Check out our e-paper at www.deccanheraldepaper.com. To read news on the go, sign up to our Telegram channel t.me/deccanheraldnews. Keep up with the news from your interested sphere by downloading the all-new Deccan Herald app, in which you can personalize, have quick glance at news shots, check highlights, and even listen too. You can get it from Google Play Store and Apple App Store, and you can find the links to the same in the description.